Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Happy Boxing Day to the civilized countries that celebrate it. And happy birthday to my son, Ferg, whom you heard reading Tuesday night and whom you heard noodling about on his get fiddle. This is The Horn, headonradionetwork.com. Most easily found by going to said web address, headonradionetwork.com, and clicking Listen Live. When the show is live, you get the live program. When it's not, well, you get the rerun stream, so unless something's gone sideways here, there should always be something playing on the Horn stream. If you hear Glockenspiel music, it means that something's gone sideways here. So that's how that works. Also available in a variety of places like, the apps for TuneIn Radio. TuneIn Radio Pro is really handy. It doesn't cost very much. And it makes it possible to record the program for later listening if you wish. You can also get the app for Stitcher Radio. There's an app for Tuner Internet Radio. The podcasting address is under this show's subdomain at whiterosesociety.org. Podcasting address is there. You can set up your feed that way, or you can go over and grab the podcast at iTunes. See how easy it is? Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. Just as Mark Twain wrote of Adam talking about Sundays, I suppose we can say now here on the 26th day of December, Christmas 2012, pulled through. Although I have a suggestion, if anybody's up for this, mind you. And I bet I'm probably not the only guy who's like this, the only person who's like this. I've thought it was Sunday all day long. I mean, it took me a while to realize that, no, wait a minute, this is prayer meeting Wednesday. So with that in mind, I'd like to make a proposal. I mean, can we just standardize Christmas to Sunday? The second to last Sunday in, or the last Sunday. I don't care. The last Sunday doesn't matter. But can we just standardize Christmas to the last Sunday in December? I mean, Jesus, we Monday holidayed just about it. And then you get a Monday holiday for Boxing Day. Then the Boxing Day tradition takes off. And well, look, there you go. Because, really, isn't the day after Christmas just a little weird? It certainly has been for me. And it's, well, not weird, but it's always been different. Well, for 17 years now, it's been different. Because it was on Christmas Day, 1995, that Agnes looked at me and said, "You know what? It's time to go." Now, I had spent all day Christmas saying, "Honey, why don't we just go to the hospital? It looks nasty outside. Looks like it's going to snow." "No, no, no, no. I'll be fine." His due date was December 25th. "No, no, 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 no." So then, after the sun had set on a short day, and after a good foot of snow had piled up on the roads, and, of course, nobody's going to pay, no state road is going to pay triple time to get somebody out to plow and scrape, Agnes looked at me and said, "You know, I think you're right. We should leave." And so we did. On a 16-mile journey over winding, hill-climbing, two-lane road. Out to, and I was sitting there, four-wheel drive, truck, you know, thinking, well, it'll be better when we get to the interstate. No, it wasn't. It was much worse. Because that was just a much wider expanse of stuff that you couldn't tell what was road and what was berm and what was medium. But December the 26th has always been a little bit bubbled off plum for us for the last 17 years. But it's just bizarre, the day after Christmas. Ray writing in, they're not going to change Christmas for you, Bob. Control freak issues? No, actually, reality issues, Ray. Because there is, I guess there's a 1 in 365 chance that Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer, really was born on December the 25th, but most everybody now seems to agree that it was probably up in the spring. One guy who was calculating the numbers of angels dancing on pinheads and whatever said it was April 17th. I guess that makes sense, Jesus the Taurus. There's certainly a good pun in there with Torah. He was, after all, a rabbi. But no, it's just a weird day. Weird day. And expecting, by the way, just a little bit of a caveat, expecting nasty weather, had some nasty earlier. I mean, howling winds. I think we got some more shingles in the yard. Expecting some more nasty weather that may knock out power. I've had a couple of phone calls from people telling me that power has been going out south of here and south of the river. So we'll cross our fingers. But it is. It's the day after Christmas. I hope you all had a good Christmas. Every Christmas, I harbor a deep and secret hope that there will be seconds on the Yorkshire pudding. Never works out that way. But I do have the make. And, you know, Yorkshire pudding is nothing but flour and milk and salt and eggs. The trick being in the baking technique. And a really hot oven and smoking hot oil or fat or butter or whatever. And it's yummy. So probably after the show, I'm going to make another pan of Yorkshire pudding and try to go and hide somewhere with it. But I hope everyone did have a good Christmas. And by good, I don't mean laden with consumer goods. What do we call that? Happy inventory clearance season? Hicks? Yeah. No, good time with family. Pleasant times with the ones you loved. And hopefully still love. Because that's what it boiled down to here. And it's pleasant and affirming when it's that way. We get reflective toward the end of a year. And I've got a rather long, but not tiresome, a rather long reflection on year's end and the horn and family and what all this effort means that we pull together five nights a week, you, me, we. Philip wrote it from Maryland. He said, as a result of your inspiration, the horn has become an incredible and unique family. Despite the separation of miles and the reality that we listeners have never met and may never meet one another, I often feel that I have begun to know so many, if only to glimpse an intimate moment through the program. Kevin and his deep passion and concern for people. Carol and his straightforward way of expressing his cogent and interesting views. Andy and his fervor and passion for change and willingness to commit himself to the hard work to achieve it. Jim, the epitome of the Southern gentleman, philosopher, with his keen humor, fascinating stories, wide interests, and varied experiences, all conveyed through an accent that makes me want to draw up a chair and just listen in silent enjoyment as I once listened to my grandfather's stories and relating of history. Juanita and her warm Southern charm and concerned observations, and so many others. Listening on election night was like celebrating with friends, even though we were wary of the chameleon-like aspects of the corporate-sponsored, allegedly Democratic victor. I even briefly overcame my shyness and fear of making a fool of myself and tried to call to join the conversation, which you did, and admirably so. To hear the cries of Brother Albert and Renee's newborn son was unique for radio and so moving. My daughters are grown, but his sleep-deprived joy and expression of appreciation for his wife returned me to the immediacy of the amazement, love, and intimacy I felt for my wife and my newborn daughters when I watched them born. I'm not religious, but if there were ever a moment to believe in the majesty of creation and the possibility of a kind, merciful, and loving Creator, it would be while I observed the miracle of birth and strength and endurance of my wife. I always cringe when men say, "We are pregnant," or "We are having a baby," because the truth is that we men rely on the strength and commitment of our women to give us the greatest of gifts, the ability to watch new life taking its first breath. My wife cannot understand the awe and sense of wonder I felt because she was too preoccupied with mentally overcoming the pain and fatigue. I may be overly sentimental, Philip says, but there is no moment when my wife was more beautiful than that when she was holding our newborn. To me, her skin looked radiant but subdued, as if she were basking in soft candlelight, and the look of serenity on her face as she held our child was breathtaking. Maybe it was the realization that I could never bear children or appreciate what she underwent, but my youngest is now 19, and I remember her and her older sister's birth as if they occurred yesterday. Similarly, when I listen to Sandra cogently discussing the issues and politics of the day in her unique and insightful way, and hear the sounds of the children she is raising in the background, I'm amazed that she balances helping raise those children with attending school and somehow finds the time to not only read the day's news but to analyze it and make it so readily comprehensible and acutely real in terms of how it will affect all of us. I imagine more than a few people regard Brother Albert and Preston as the Horn's resident optimists, and I would agree. However, when I listen to the level of commitment and passion that Andy and Sandra and others express, I think that their concern masks a deeper belief that we are capable of and can achieve so much better. A guarded optimism, if you will. What impresses me most about the Horn's conversations are not just the professionals who call in and offer their learned perspectives, for which I am grateful, but the Renaissance men and women, Sandra, Jim, Albert, Kevin, and others, who have so many diverse interests and are so knowledgeable about so many different topics. I have read and studied a great deal, but I need to learn so much more before I can hope to make an equivalent contribution to the conversation. Don't sell yourself short, Philip. In this capitalist empire, we men and more women nowadays define ourselves by what we do and earn. Yet I think of all the Horn callers who are retired or living on limited incomes on disability and offer and contribute so much to my understanding of the world. They find richness in living and experiencing the world, which is atypical for those who live on limited incomes in a capitalist society that respects only the worth of those who focus on acquiring material wealth and seeks to impress upon the rest of us that we haven't worked, tried, or earned enough, yearned enough to be successful human beings. To listen to the Horn for an evening, or watch a group of young athletic millionaires play children's games for the entertainment of those who can afford the exorbitant price of tickets, or alternatively, tolerate the loud and abrasive commercials to watch them on television, I know what choice I consistently make. After all, the former entails being a passive onlooker to others' alleged achievements in a culture in which teachers will be underpaid and overworked so new stadiums can be built and generous tax breaks afforded to those wealthy few who anesthetize us through entertainment. Here's the deal as succinctly as I can put it. Not only has the Horn changed my impression of white Southerners and forced me to dispel the jaded views and prejudices I developed from living in Texas for 10 years, that is, I moved there thinking my Yankee preconceptions and prejudices would be altered by actually living there, and instead left with even firmer convictions about the rigidity, close-mindedness, and intolerance of so many whites living in the Bible Belt. but the horn has also changed the views I held, despite my better judgment about what people offer when they can no longer work. As a chronically ill and handicapped individual at the end of my working years, I have grappled with how I will define myself now that I am no longer doing anything, quotes around that, have suffered a marked decrease in standard of living, and have finally, albeit begrudgingly, accepted the physical limitations that I have tried to fight for so long. Kevin, Tracy, and her survival of brain surgery. Juanita and her tenacity and cheerfulness after experiencing serious health problems. And Maura, who called from the hospital just to say goodbye and thank you, have all caused me to discard my deeply held fears of losing meaning when I can no longer work and am limited by illness and income. For they still live, laugh, and involve themselves deeply in the issues of the day, and more importantly, express unique and vivid personalities, perspectives, and humor whenever they call. They express self-worth that defies the limited categories that are deemed worthwhile or productive in today's United States. I also think of Jim, who defies all stereotypes of the narrow-minded conservative bureaucrat working in and negotiating the quixotic and ethically challenged intricacies of government agencies devoted to defense and other more secretive missions done in our name but without our knowledge. Brother Albert, the sage of southwest Wisconsin, the philosophical, eternally optimistic pizza maker, spouse, and father, and a certain erudite and widely read passionate hillbilly moderator named Bob Kincaid. I listen awful, often. Yeah. Yeah, maybe passionate, but not coherent. I listen often to the loving way in which you talk about your family and Agnes, and listened last night to the pride expressed before and after your daughter and son read the Christmas fable from the Gospels of the King James Bible, Ferg's graceful and determined guitar playing despite the inadequate studio equipment and sound engineer with which he had to cope.
That would be me.
And above all, your passion, zest, and curiosity. West Virginia's lucky to have you. This is the part where we have to put the clamp on my head, okay? Agnes probably wouldn't let me read this. I grew up in an environmental disaster, Philip says, and as I have previously written, saw so many, almost half of the adults in my neighborhood die from cancer. I left to live elsewhere, to return and stick it out and retain the commitment and fervor for change, for the better every day is something I admire deeply, but having watched my mother and almost one half of my neighbors die from various cancers while the local, state, and federal government denied any nexus with the monstrous polluter and environmental disaster less than a quarter mile away that poisoned our water, I had to leave in my early 30s. Now you stay and fight day after day and travel the country giving speeches, inspiring others, and entreating lawmakers to do what they're supposed to do. Serve the common good amazes me. Much as I love my home state, I have no desire to return to the neighborhood in which I grew up and watched so many become ill and die, or who died after I left. I had already witnessed the failure of government to protect citizens' health when I was in my late teens. My mother, a registered nurse, worked at a state-run tuberculosis hospital, caring for the many immigrants from the Azores and other poor places in Europe. She was regularly tested for tuberculosis, however, the state misinterpreted the results of several tests. During midterm exams when I was in college, I was informed that she had collapsed, bleeding from the mouth and lungs in front of my 4-year-old brother and might not survive. She lost most of one lung, and within a few years, the state settled monetarily for its negligence. It didn't replace the lung that was lost. My mother continued to work, but was never as healthy, and after a second bout of cancer, this time in her lungs, which metastasized, she died at 55, 3 years younger than I am now. So I was glad to leave 24 years ago and have only gone back 3 times to visit friends and attend a wedding. Perhaps were I older and a homeowner, I would have stayed to fight the polluters after I worked my way through college. But I doubt it. As you know firsthand, the forces of opposition are formidable. And so must you and those who fight mountaintop removal be to maintain faith that change can eventually be achieved in the lives of your families and West Virginia citizens. Can be better safeguarded. I watched the trauma of the Upper Big Branch mine disaster unfold so painfully on television. I recall hearing that the miners were often fearful for their safety in the mines, but earned what was considered a very good income for the area, $50,000. Watching the suffering of the family, seeing the beauty of the area, but too the weather-worn houses and faces of the people, I thought it was my idea of an earthly hell. to descend into the darkness of the earth at great risk at a minimum to one's lungs, days in and day out, while one's families never knew with certainty that one would return home at night because of the needless hazards of one's occupation to earn a mere $50,000 was incomprehensible to me, especially after the perfectly coiffed Joe Manchin reminisced proudly about his and his family's days in the mines, as if having to do the filthy, unsafe work of extracting rocks for the pet profit of mine owners and stockholders and the profligate energy use of the nation was an admirable way of life worth preserving rather than one of the few alternatives in a poor state by which one could support one's family. At the time, I thought, with respect to Manchin, you worked and lost relatives in the mines, knew many who contracted black lung disease, and have the audacity to maintain that it is a way of life worth preserving, and of which one can be proud despite one's ravaged lungs. You encourage the families to fear change and focus their anger and trepidation on those who seek to halt that greedy industry's plundering of the earth and lives. That Manchin has governed and held a Senate seat without being arrested for prostitution amazes me. But miners' families are very much like my relatives after my cousin was killed in Vietnam. They fervently defended the meaninglessness of the cause rather than contend with the emptiness of knowing a life was needlessly wasted. On those few occasions when I find you a bit too strident or veering toward melodrama and your filibusters, I realize how ignorant I am of the pressures and threats you and your family face daily living in that impoverished yet beautiful state that, like underdeveloped countries, exports its resources so others can profit and live well. Having lived in Maryland for 14 years, I now have some appreciation for that threatened existence, a reality that also endures in the mountains and hills of western Maryland. You and the others who battle for a healthier and saner state are quiet heroes, and when you become most frustrated and maybe even momentarily discouraged, please think of how much you influence and inspire those of us who listen and marvel at your fortitude. One last comment, and being Christmas, it veers toward the schmaltzy. I was never so glad to have one of my weird and cryptic emails read as when you read my comments about Candy Crowley, and Agnes chuckled in the background. My wife was also listening in the background, and she, too, chuckled when she heard Agnes. That laughter, or the comments of those who agree or laugh occasionally when I submit something, delight me. To me, it is all part of the uniqueness of the horn. There may be anger and frustration at daily events expressed in conversations, but there is never hatred, racism, or bigotry, and in the end, there is always time for humor. How sad it is that reactionaries and conservatives have no similar programs and instead listen to spite, resentment, and bitter hatred and bigotry day after day on the commercial airwaves. Thank you, Philip. Thank you kindly. I wanted to share that with you just because. Because I get reminders every now and then of the importance this holds for so many. Well, see, I've screwed up math again. I said there was a 1 in 365 chance that Jesus was born on December 25th. You know, one of these days I'll learn not to do math on the fly. Thank goodness there's folks like Dr. John out there. I'm not so sure, says Dr. John. I'm not so sure about that. It assumes there's an equal chance of the initial act happening every day. That's assuming, of course, that the birth of Jesus was a completely natural event. I'd imagine God doesn't have the same constraints. Of course, one wonders then why Mary went through a full gestation period. Or labor! And yeah, I'm definitely on greased rails to hell for this. Oh, man, you know, if that's the case, Dr. John, then, you know, it's gonna be a long, long train, because we're all on the greased rails. Dr. John continued and said, Philip's heartfelt note moved me to tears, a perfect and personal tribute to people and ideas I hold so dear. Thank you. Indeed. Ray noting, what elegant words. glad Darlene could get a giggle out of dancing on pinheads. Toaster, she says. This came in over the last couple of days from Kate. She said, the Horn is the only talk radio I listen to. I work in a team of policy consultants to government, and I'm fortunate to see the good people who work in the bureaucracy that is government. It drives me so bonkers when I see blind idealism and demagoguery override the compromise and practicalities that must form the core of good government. She says, the Horn's voice is so needed, so very needed. Thank you, Kate. And that's not Kate on the front range. That's a different Kate. We've got more than We started out with a bunch of Davids, and now we've got just about extra of everybody now. Not extra, but not duplicates either. Oh dear. Thank you, Kate. Texas Betsy noting, clearly Mary went through labor because she is a woman. See, I feel that way too. But this being prayer meeting, it is not improper, I don't think, to note that certain religious bodies believe that she gave birth, and just don't blame the messenger. She got pregnant, gestated a baby in her womb, carried it to term, and gave birth, and at no point in time did she ever stop being a virgin. Sort that one out. Of course, there's a whole lot of sorting out to do. But, yeah, you know, it's like conversations I've had with Ferg. Now, son, you know, that's what you have to believe if you're going to be one of them. You have to believe that, well, that. And that, well, never mind. It's not worth it. But it is prayer meeting Wednesday. And we do have some prayer meeting Wednesday stuff. But, Alan, let me put this out there real quick. I got a note from Sparky, our chat room moderator, and our also the moderator of the Horn Malloy Skype group, late nights on Fridays and occasionally on holiday special occasions. And Sparky, otherwise known as Duncan, said, I put $50 in the mail. Use it as a Horn Malloy Skype group challenge. So that's what this is. If you participate in the Horn Malloy Skype group, help match that 50, and that'll get us a long way toward making tonight's fundraising goal of 150. 150 every night, that's what we try to raise. And thank you so much for the kindness of the contributions that have happened yesterday and every day. That's what keeps all of this going. So there's a $50 challenge on the table for the Horn Malloy Skype group. Now, over the last few days, this story over at Boston.com from the Boston Globe about it's being seen pretty much as being about Tag Romney has garnered a lot of attention. Most people have seen Tag Romney's, and I'm never sure if he's the one that looks like an Osmond or not, but have seen Tag Romney's words to the effect that his dad, Willard, wanted to be president less than any other man he's ever known. We'll leave that statement alone, because it's been adequately cussed and discussed and parsed and parsley and parsnipped by people much better than I. But a lot of folks have looked at that article with some fascination. Many are thinking it just looks like a case of sour grapes. Well, he didn't want to be president anyway. But as usual, there are little things out there that I notice, just because I'm weird, that maybe others don't. This article over at the Boston Globe is basically a post-mortem on the failures of the Romney campaign and why they got beaten so absolutely badly. And it goes through failure to prepare, bad software design, all kinds of stuff. But in the course of the article, there's a discussion about the two philosophies that were put to work, or that duped it out for primacy in the course of the campaign. And the one of them was that, based on polling numbers, the Romney campaign should be about what a bad president Barack Obama had been, was being. The other school of thought came from Queen Anne herself and some other interior folks to La Familia Romney, who said that the campaign should focus on what a great guy Willard is. And this is where the weirdness comes in. They wanted to highlight moments of his extreme compassion, his commitment and determination and dedication. The only problem is, the examples themselves were less than inspiring. Because what was, and this one instance was repeated, I think, no less than three times in this Boston Globe article. They wanted to point out what a warm and kind and caring man Willard is by recounting the story of how he went to the bedside of a terminally ill 14-year-old to help him write his will. And the first time I went past that, I thought, well, and just kept reading. But then it got repeated again. Or then it got repeated. Repeated again the third time. It got repeated. And I stopped for a minute and said, wait a minute. Hold on, wait a minute. Usually when you're talking about the compassion of a political candidate, I don't know, there's some hand kissing or baby shaking involved. But not here. No. Not here. in this case, it was about helping a 14-year-old write a will. And you just kind of, what? Now, maybe I'm having a hard time making this clear. But generally speaking, at least out here among the hoi polloi, when someone like a 14-year-old is terminally ill, usually things take the shape of, can we get him to Disney World? Or maybe she's always wanted to see the Louvre. That's what things like the Make-A-Wish Foundation exist for. Over the course of this past Christmas, we had several cases of, or several stories of young people who simply wanted letters. And because of the power of social media, the word went out, and what started out as a hope for 10,000 letters turned out to be a reality of, you know, a 500,000 or something. And you go, well, yeah. And then the letters are generally distributed among others in similar circumstances. So the more I thought about it, the weirder it got. Kind of like chewing an oyster. The more you chew, the bigger it gets. Until I realized that that was classic Romney. Not, hey son, let me help you get out in the sunshine, or you know, let's go see the Grand Canyon, or no. It was, let me help you write that will. And I realize that this sort of betrays my lack of acumen of what it's like to live in the kind of world that a Willard Romney lives in. But what does a 14-year-old have to bequeath? Unless you're a Romney kid, in which case you've probably got a stake in some massive trust fund of some hundreds of millions of dollars that's been set up for you as a tax shelter for your daddy's wealth. It would appear that Ray is as cynical as I. For Ray writes in and says, how much was going to the Mormon church? You know, son, and this is prayer meeting Wednesday after all. You know, son, you're facing your reality, but we're Mormons, and we believe in a resurrection of the body and the spirit. And we believe you're going to get your own planet. So you want to get that will done right, so that you don't get some low-rent planet full of Baptists or something, or worse yet, a planet full of the seven-legged, three-armed atheists. You want a good planet with lots of sister wives. Let's get that will nailed down real good and tight, son. But even in the moment when they were looking for something that would mark Willard's comprehension of his common humanity, that's what they came up with. He helped a 14-year-old write a will. Now, Texas Betsy notes here. She says, I know a terminally ill 12-year-old who wrote a goodbye letter to her family and specified who she wanted her toys and books to go to. Most went to the hospital that took care of her. I understand that. But that is not this. What this was, and it was made clear, was really a will. Not one last walk to feel the sunset, the warm rays of the sun on his face. Not even one last trip down the slopes. Not one more moment of the salt spray of the sea in his face. Not meeting his favorite NFL player, or his favorite baseball player, or his favorite hockey player, or basketball player, or curling player. No. The display of the warmth of Willard Romney was to be had. He's not. Is he even a member of anybody's bar? Is he a practicing lawyer? No, it took the form of helping a terminally ill 14-year-old write a will. And even more telling was the fact that the family brought that up over and over again to the campaign, saying, see, this'll make people understand that Dad's human. They are that divorced from reality. Of course, there was that Washington Post story of a few weeks back, immediately after, a couple of weeks after the election, where Anne was described as struggling to enjoy riding horses again. It is recounted in Ernest Hemingway's A Movable Feast that he and F. Scott Fitzgerald had an ongoing dispute about whether the rich were the same as you and me, or the rich are very different from you and me. Hemingway took the side of the same, and Fitzgerald took the side of very different. I think anecdotes like this prove that Fitzgerald had the greater understanding. And, of course, considering some of the circles he had moved in, he might have also had the greater store of empirically gathered data. How bizarre. How utterly strange. I mean, why not? Well, aren't there a dozen things you do for a family in that circumstance? Don't you have to go through the full dozen, or maybe two dozen, before you get to help him dispose of his assets? I don't mean to sound cold toward the youth who passed away. Maybe will signing has something special about it inside Mormon orthodoxy. But I suspect those speculations are off. It's just how Willard's mind works.
Do you have any assets? Oh, we need to get those taken care of so there won't be any fights afterward and everybody can be happy and think about him enjoying his life on planet Norblap 7, being adored as a god by all the inhabitants thereof.
It's just weird. Never having been through a terminal illness situation, but having been a child and a sibling died, I can tell you that's just weird. I can remember the very day itself. One of my father's colleagues from the plant showed up with his wife, and before anything, I was whisked away to an ice cream store. I was 7. Oh, you can have anything you want. It's okay to cry. And the steady parade of neighbors and friends and church people through our front door to make sure that no one had to lift a finger to take care of the daily necessities of living. Everything from fried chicken to pies, green beans, homemade rolls. Even checking to make sure that the laundry didn't need done. Because in such situations, you don't need to be worrying about the small stuff. But among us plebs, I guess it was different. Because nobody visited to say, were his financial affairs in order? Maybe I'm completely off base with this, but that just struck me as strange. Strange as much in the doing of it as in the fact that the fence... See, that shows what a good guy Dad is. He worries about dying kids' money. Dr. John wrote in. He said you nailed it on the Romney anecdote. Yes. The message in that act is clear. The most important thing to do in one's life is take care of your possessions. Experiences and human relations and shared memories are secondary to things and status. Can't help but think this wasn't a selfless act, but a subtle dog whistle about the estate tax. It's a heartbreaking story made more so by the cynical political move he used with a dying child. Ron and Raleigh noting, Bob, don't you realize now, or by now, that it's all about the Benjamins? Yeah. Jim, with my having conjured F. Scott Fitzgerald, notes that F. Scott Fitzgerald once said, at age 18, our views are the mountaintops from which we speak. At 81, they become the caves in which we hide. And F. Scott Fitzgerald was right. Without ever having gotten to see what 81 felt or smelt or even tasted like. By the way, we are, thank you very kindly to the two of you, we are $10 away from meeting
Sparky's challenge. And that is deeply helpful as we try to finish out the month. Philip, from whom we heard at the beginning of the program, who touched you all so deeply, says, Romney, where there's a will, there's a way. Philip's in rare form. I've always considered it a gross injustice that Jerzy Kosinski never was credited for prophesying and being there the Romney candidacy, its mindless champion, and all its empty meaninglessness. As for poor Tag Romney, we men always realize at some point in adolescence that our fathers are not the flawless, unblemished men we worshipped and emulated without reservation when young. Face it, Tag. Of all the men you've known and have yet to know, your father will always be the biggest dick you encounter. John the Wad Holmes would have been embarrassed at your father's personality and all its dickness, dickhood, dickivity, or whatever the noun is, surpassed anything he could demonstrate physically in his illustrious film career. Face it, Tag. The biggest metaphysical challenge you will have from now on is trying to figure out how aliens from a distant galaxy absconded with the soul and mind of the Mexican immigrant Jorge Romney's newborn son and replaced them with defective robotics, and despite their secret wisdom and ceremonies, the holy leaders at the temple never, ever realized the sleight of hand. Oh well, there's always Orrin Hatch or Harry Reid. Alas that I am growing old, I could have ventured west as a young man and made a fortune selling human personalities in Utah. Utah, where in the wake of the Newtown massacre, a child, 12 years old, I think, was sent to school with an unloaded .22 caliber pistol. You know, just in case. Utah. So, that's not, I guess it doesn't come off as being truly prayer meeting-esque, but it sure does tell you a lot about people when you find out what they care about at the end of life. Here it is about 8 minutes, or no, 6 minutes before the hour. That math thing is going to dog me for the rest of my days. I can't even do math on a clock well. And here endeth the filibobster. There is an abundance of stuff to be considered in the course of the evening. And you are welcome to add to it or go in an entirely different direction. The right-wingers are out there hee-hawing for David Gregory's head on a spit because he displayed one of them high-capacity magazines on the Meet the Prostitutes yesterday. And them things is illegal in Washington, D.C. Had to get it. They got it from the props department at NBC. That's how he got it. But I'm the last guy in the world to defend a member of the for-profit media like David Gregory. Sorry, no. Not in the least. But there's that. There's the latest horror out of, in this case, Memphis, Tennessee. Christmas Day in Memphis, where a 10-year-old boy in a house full of family celebrating the holiday was blown away with a weapon in the family. He was blown away by his 12-year-old brother. And it's almost too much horror to contemplate. One wonders if Willard Romney would have rushed to the 10-year-old's side to see if his financial affairs were in order. No word yet from Wayne LaPierre as to whether or not the only way to stop a bad kid with a gun is a good kid with a gun. According to WMCTV, we still don't really know to whom the firearm belonged on Christmas in Memphis. We also don't know why a firearm was left out and out in a family's celebration of Christmas. We don't know why a firearm was left out and about and loaded at a family's celebration of Christmas. But we know that now is not the time to discuss any of that. Just ask the National Rifle Association. Right? Right. So, let's go forthwith to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. This is Carol in Las Vegas.
Hey, Carol. How are you?
I'm doing all right. How are you these days?
Got through Christmas. Worried about we're worried about our daughter and all of that. But
well, I was mainly wondering about your health problems. You haven't talked a lot about that lately.
Because mostly they've been one, behaving themselves, and two, not just a hell of a lot to be done about them.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I can try to modify diet and eat a little healthier and things like that, but you know, ultimately,
I was just going to say, have you just been able to maybe modify your diet a little bit and keep everything more under control that way? Then
that seems to be the case.
So, what are you eating these days?
A lot of soup.
Yeah,
I'm back to the wonderful world of soup. Although yesterday, last few days, on Sunday we went to the, over to our eldest daughter and her husband's house and, did some family tradition over there.
Mm-hmm. The oysters and all.
Yeah. But so far so good. And then yesterday, if I had eaten my fill of Yorkshire pudding, maybe my gallbladder would be rebelling, but so far, no.
Well, I was just curious. You haven't spoken about it. So, well, at least it's at a position where you have a little bit of control over it until you can do something about it, which is good, I guess.
Yeah, and I had a nice note back on the last flare-up. I can't recall the name at present, but I put some of the advice into play, and that seems to have helped as well.
That's good. Well, I guess, first of all, I was just going to let you know that Shauna's husband was indicted. The grand jury indicted him for, about 8 counts of conspiracy to murder, burglary, and, you know, I don't know exactly all of them. A friend of mine at work, I went online and read a little bit about it. So he got indicted, and he's going to be January 3rd. He goes to court for the his plea, which he's going to plead not guilty. So I guess they'll set a trial date at that point. So I'm just letting You know, I think what's kind of interesting is two of the waitresses at work who are close to all of this, and one of them's married to a fireman. Evidently, there's still quite a few firemen who don't think he did anything, which is pretty incredible when you think about it, and are actually standing behind him. You know, it's amazing to me how people can't see what's in front of their own eyes, but I guess we should be getting pretty used to that by now.
So, denial is a very powerful thing, Carol.
No, it is. I mean, and let's face it, sometimes even people like you and I and all of us have to use some of it just to, you know, carry on at times. But, you know, I was thinking in the last week or so, you know, a lot of the talk about what went on in Connecticut and everything, and I started thinking about when I was a kid. And, you know, I was born in 1953, so you can work the math out when I was in junior high, I mean, grade school and junior high. But I was thinking about how, what is the difference between back then and today? And it seems to me that, you know, when I was young, there wasn't things like Fox News and right-wing radio spewing lies everywhere. It's just something, you know, that wasn't around. You had newspapers, of course, and you had ABC and NBC and CBS, and journalists were pretty responsible back then for the most part. But in thinking about this, I'm really beginning to believe that a lot of the problems we're seeing today stem from just, and, you know, it's something that you talk about and Malloy talks about, but it's just stemming from this constant barrage of lies and how it's affecting our society. And I sometimes I think it may just boil down to that. What do you think?
I don't think under these circumstances, Carol, that we can say it boils down to one thing. I don't know. Maybe the pot's got too much stuff in it for anything. Because, you know, by the time, if you think about that metaphor, by the time you've boiled something down, there's generally a lot of different stuff in what's left.
Mm-hmm.
And, this country went sideways a lot of different times in a lot of different ways. There's an argument to be had about the effect of media. And media can be television or movies. Media, I suppose, can be video games. But those sorts of things are so far attenuated out from straight up cause and effect that it seems it's not necessarily a waste of time. But I go back to the analogy that I've been using about the burning barn. That you don't bring up paint swatches for what the new one's going to be while you're still trying to put the old fire out.
No, I remember that analogy, and I agree with you to a certain point. But I think that, okay, if you take just the situation with the type of rifle that was used, and let's say we ban them, which is fine. Let's say we do that. You know, you can still do a lot of damage with a handgun. You can still actually do a lot of damage with regular weapons. And again, I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying that...
No, I recognize that. I recognize that completely. But in light of the fact that there we were on Christmas Eve learning of another shooting, this time in upstate New York on the shores of Lake Ontario, in which... A guy who left a manifesto or note or whatever that said he was going to go out doing what he liked to do best, that is, killing people, and that's nearly a quote.
Yeah, I read that. I did read that.
And the fact that he went in with a shotgun, a pistol, and a Bushmaster.
And the Bushmaster is what was the effective weapon. I understand that.
Right, and the .38 caliber pistol was for the coup de grace, if you will, where he killed himself at the end.
Right, for himself. And, you know, like I say, I'm not arguing with you on that. I think that even though I own some firearms, I would be behind banning them tomorrow. I would be behind banning any sales at gun shows tomorrow. I guess I'm just, what I was trying to figure out in my own mind was not the final action of what these people are doing, but what gets them to that desperation.
Right. How it, and that's an open question, Carol, because I've asked myself, if we responded as Australia did,
mm-hmm.
and Australia has not had another such problem since. I mean, sure, there are killings and murders, and so that's human. That's part of the human condition.
Mm-hmm.
But they've not had another similar event involving that weapon and that number of dead. 31 at the time, if I recall. The port was it Port Arthur massacre?
I think so.
Yeah.
Well,
and so I think it's a fair question to ask: is that a saner culture? And I think we get to ask questions about the relative sanity of our culture. I think we get to ask, at least as liberals or progressives, Carol, I think we get to ask questions about what happens to a culture that is, at least for the recent past, constantly at war. Because war will come home, whether you like it, you know, whether you want to admit it or not. And no matter how hard you yell, not you, of course, but no matter how hard people yell, for instance, on the right-wing side, no matter how hard they yell for Ward Churchill to be dismissed for suggesting that 9/11 was a case of the chickens coming home to roost, it doesn't change the fact that should probably be discussed. And that's, you know, that's another core problem of this country. We don't discuss hard problems. Instead, we have isolated, insular pockets of media that tell us what we want to hear and what we ought to think. I've got a photograph here on my Facebook page that Michael sent in, one of our Michaels, and he had a bumper sticker on his car that said "Turn off Fox, bad news for America." Somebody went out to his car with a Sharpie, Carol, and fairly carefully blocked out the word Fox and changed it to NBC.
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, your point about the use of weapons that are mass killers, and it would be like, okay, let's say the NRA lobbyists and the right wingers and all that made it possible for us to go buy RPGs, okay, where you're launching grenades into people's homes or whatever, and then you would have even more violence. So your point is correct. You know, to wind down the worst of the worst. And it does have a positive effect. But just what you were saying about somebody going out and changing, and that's another reason why for decades now I don't put anything on my car. because right wingers are nuts. And bringing it kind of back to what I said, when I think about my life in the 70s, where there was no Fox News, there was no Rush Limbaugh and all that kind of thing, you know, I'm a pretty bright guy, and we did not have the type of craziness that we have now, because there wasn't that lying information being spewed out there to change people's minds. I don't know. Do you think I'm wrong on this?
No, I don't. And I don't, especially in light of the story that came up, I think, Christmas Eve, where we talked about the guy who left Indiana, drove to Toledo with guns and gasoline cans in order to set fire to a mosque there, the Islamic Center of Greater Toledo or whatever it was, and when inquired by the judge upon his guilty plea, said, "I don't know nothing about no Muslims, I don't know no Muslims, I don't know nothing about no Islam, but I know that they're a war at us because Fox told me so."
Exactly. And you know they had to be cringing on the right in certain power sources, because they don't want anybody saying anything like that. You know, we on the farther left, you know, we've been saying this for years, but for that to actually go out on the mainstream media, you know, they had to be cringing quite a bit.
Well, but it didn't. I mean, that was over at Gawker, so it's not like It was God knows it wasn't covered on Fox, but it also wasn't covered on CNN or ABC or NBC either, or CBS.
Well, I know that it was brought up on the Stephanie Miller show, which is
well, that's great. I mean, that means that it got wider airplay.
Well, like I said, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine in the last 2 days over the holidays, who's out of work and everything, and I actually know quite a few people in Las Vegas who are unemployed and they're having a really hard time finding work. And there's just a lot of pressure out there, Bob. I mean, there's just a lot of desperation. And I think that even this kid who did the Connecticut shooting, I think there's more than just the availability of gun and his mental problems. I think there was probably desperation. I think a lot of young people feel desperation. I mean, you know, I don't have children. You do. Even within your own children, how do they feel about as they get older and they're coming into their early 20s, and are they feeling, for instance, when I was 19 years old, I didn't have a care in the world. There were so many jobs, I didn't even think about not having a job or doing anything.
That's not their reality, Carol, that's for sure. They're nervous, to say the very least.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we talk about going to, you know, we talk about college, but any talk about college has to be accompanied by talks about financial aid, loans, and God knows, hopefully scholarships or grants in aid.
Mm-hmm.
Which means...
go ahead.
No, which means that there are a multitude of potential stumbling blocks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things become dependent on standardized test scores.
Well, and you see, this is what I'm talking about in this ramping up of pressure on our young people. When I went to the University of Houston, I remember I can't remember exactly what I paid, but it was very, very cheap. I mean, literally, it might have been, I don't know, $300 a semester plus books. And what is it now? It's just astronomical.
Oh, it's. And that's the thing, even for what was once upon a time a fairly inexpensive proposition going to a state school, that's brutally expensive now. Community college is brutally expensive. And then on top of that, you've got these for-profit back-of-the-matchbook affairs, and that is a huge... And they'll let anybody in. The degree isn't worth a damn. And they sit there and suck up the funding from people who come from roughly the same approximate circumstances as my kids do. That is, got to get some college, and no idea how.
Mm-hmm. Well, and so it doesn't just appear that I'm rambling here. I guess what I said in the beginning about the difference between the late 50s and the 60s when I was a kid. Until now, I'm speaking of this feeling of pressure and desperation I see amongst the younger people that I work with. And when I say younger, in late 20s, 30s, their feelings about, you know, they have young children. And I'm just saying that as this comes up, when the Congress starts again, and there's probably going to be some movement on the legislation for... some of these weapons, but then are they going to start tackling other problems that are going to make a big difference? In that, okay, let's say we get rid of assault rifle. Well, gee, that's really good, but
that doesn't help 2 million people who are going to lose their unemployment coverage.
Exactly, and I just feel that so much of what we're seeing in some of this craziness, I'm afraid, is the tip of the iceberg, because as people feel more desperation and they see less way out, I'm just very concerned. I mean, even with myself, at 59, my job, I have to keep it because I can't replace it. And that's stressful.
That's terrifying.
And I'm an adult, you know, and younger people don't have the type of skills that people like you and I may learn later in life to say, well, okay, this was a bad day and I feel really tired or I feel really depressed, just wait for tomorrow. But younger people may not have that, those abilities. And I think that some of this acting out that we're seeing is, I just believe it's coming from that pressure. I don't know if you really agree with me or not.
I think it's a sort of focused pressure, Carol. Because the only thing I can come back to is that time after time after time, no matter how desperately the right wing tries, they can't make any of these shooters into progressives or liberal people. At best, they are ambivalent. At worst, they are of and from their own.
Mm-hmm.
And so we do. I mean, I was not just utterly dismissing what you were saying. I think we need to go back and take a good hard look at the Glenn Becks of the world. And I think, to the extent that it's even possible, and by possible I refer to, you know, people like Scalia's dead constitution,
mm-hmm.
can we look at the reach? Well, let's put it this way. If a guy goes out and says, not day after day, day after day, day after day, to your face, you need to go and kill X because it's your that's where your problem lies.
Mm-hmm.
And they do it in person. One cannot help but think that there would be some way of attaching that person to any subsequent criminal act.
Mm-hmm.
But the electronic media have all before them the ability to say, well, that was just an isolated crazy man's what that was. Nobody in their right mind would, for instance, listen to Glenn Beck day in and day out and eventually get all liquored up and loaded up with firearms and head for the Tides Foundation, which really, really happened.
No, I remember that case specifically.
And so, you know, there are elements here of incitement. And I'm not saying I want any kind of a crackdown, but I'm saying that I think civilized society needs to think at least a little bit about impacts. I mean, if nothing else, you know, I'm not saying suppress anybody's free speech, but if you can prove, for instance, let's deal, and of course they'd never do it because there would be a firestorm of controversy over it, but let's say that the Islamic Society of Greater Toledo decided to go after Fox News because they could prove, you know, if they could prove cause and effect, proximate causation as the law calls it, then they would have a right, I would think, to name Fox in a suit for damages, right?
I would think.
It was the mother of the guy who went after the Tides Foundation who cited Glenn Beck.
Mm-hmm.
You would think she would know. And so, not suppress anybody, but simply apply old entrenched ideas of liability. You know, I remember when they tried that with Judas Priest or Ozzy Osbourne or whatever, it failed.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was too tenuous. But so what if the guy is mentally ill? Does his mental illness give the guy who put the gun in his hands a pass? And I don't think that's an improper inquiry.
Well, and that if it wouldn't have been for the drumbeat of the right wing, the Alex Jones who convinced his mother to have these kind of weapons in her home, then you just keep backing up until you go to what is the source, and the source was that this mother of the Connecticut shooter was convinced of a non-reality, and you go down the line, and there's the tragedy. Everything, in my opinion, has some source. Now, what we maybe they're, you know, trying to figure out a way to do something about it is pretty hard, obviously. But, you know, the premise of what I called about was just that. It seems pretty clear to me as an individual that growing up without that type of influence all around me helps shape who I am. So I can't help believe that the people who are growing up with that influence, it's shaping who they are.
Oh, and I don't think there's any getting away from that. And we can even come a little closer to home, I think, Carol, by talking about generalized gun culture versus sporting firearms culture. Now, I think, as I noted before, I think that the idea of not at least taking into account the fact that sporting is, you know, the tax dollars support shooting sports by, you know, state DNRs, game wardens, what have you. But it used to be that you heard people talking about, and you can still hear the conversations, about whether or not you want a .30-06 or a .270 in the woods during deer season, and talking about the relative effective merits of either one, or whether to use 4-shot or 6-shot or whatever in your shotgun, you know, when you're out bird hunting, and depending on what kind of bird you've got. That's sporting talk. But anymore, Carol, it seems to take almost no time whatsoever when that conversation begins for it to transition into, and you know what? That one in the White House wants my shotgun. And this is the effect of the NRA. And the NRA's mouthpiece at Fox, et cetera.
Exactly. And it all comes from this hugely supported by the corporate right wing media source that is purposely putting out all of this lying propaganda, and it comes to that. You know, now that you brought it up, I the other day when you talked about, I thought it was interesting about, you know, this whole hunting thing and, you know, going out and killing your food. You know, you were 100% right. I mean, with the amount of people on the planet today, this idea that if everybody went out and hunted their own food, there would be no fish left, there would be no birds left, there'd be no deer left. You know, that's something you were totally correct on, that I've always thought was sort of ridiculous. You know, even when I was a kid and used to go fishing, I was never a hunter. I mean, some of the lakes and streams, rivers and whatever in the West were even basically fished out back when I was 12 years old, you know. Remember when you brought that up the other day?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and nobody really talks about that, but you were right on. And that's part of a bigger picture in that, are we going to see the world we live in honestly and tackle what our problems, or are we going to live in this fantasy world where somebody thinks, well, whatever happens, I'll just go out and I'll live in a cabin and I'll fish and hunt. I mean, it's just a crazy fantasy. And yet so many people believe
it. And again, they have been taught to believe it and led to believe it, Carol. You know, idiots like Ted Nugent, who mercifully has been removed from the Discovery Channel, I might add.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and he's got 5 more months before he's either dead or in jail, apparently by his own prophecy, so I don't know which side to root for. Because he said if Obama was reelected, that, you know, that would be the outcome for him. But he's got a line of his own beef jerky, for God's sakes. And talks about, you know, how he's a manly man because he looks at what he kills before he eats it. Well, that's great, Ted, but you really want people, I don't know, shall we stock, I mean, traffic in New York is hell as it is. Do we really want to stock it with game and have people out there, you know, take it, you know, wing shooting on Wall Street for pheasant? I mean, it becomes silly just when you contemplate it. But the other side of that is that The Ted Nugents and NRA types of the world don't give a damn about people who live in cities because they consider them somehow beneath their rugged individualism. And that's another one of those myths that's out there, the rugged individualism part.
Yeah.
You know, it takes a lot of rugged individualism to get in your car that may have been built by a union worker and drive off, and drive off to the hunting preserve on roads that the rest of us who don't shoot helped pay for too. You get the idea. Rely on a clean potable water supply to rinse out the carcass. How's that?
Well, that and putting the fish in the streams and then the taxpayers. When you were talking about that, I was, you know, you're right on that. I mean, it's all so ridiculous. It really, really is. But, you know, that was the main thing I wanted to talk to you about today. I just think that when I was young and growing up, I think there was a real difference, at least in this country, on the information that was coming into my head and what was available out there. You know, I grew up on, you know, Walter Cronkite and all the other guys.
Howard K. Smith.
Channel. Exactly.
Huntley, Brinkley.
Mm-hmm. You know, the early days of 60 Minutes and things like that. And I just can't help but believe that's a big, big difference to what so many of these young people are coming up today with Fox News and Rush Limbaugh in their ear. It's just a complete different world that's coming into their head. And unfortunately, it's a world that's a lie. It's a world that's untrue.
And it's a, but it's also a world that's created, because remember, the first step in the process of creating a world safe for Fox News was to create the absolute BS, bogus myth of the liberal media, and that goes back to the days of Nixon, Carol. You know, that goes back to the conversations between Nixon and Billy Graham, where Nixon, probably half out of his mind on barbiturates, would look at Billy Graham and say, "Billy, Reverend Graham, I tell you, this country's a mess, and most of it's because of the Jews in Hollywood, Billy." And Reverend Graham would say, "Yes, Mr. President, I think you're correct. Amen."
No, I have absolutely read all that, but I think the difference is, it was Nixon talking to Billy Graham and not, you know, 100 right-wing nutcases on the radio spewing it out 24 hours a day. And, you know, when you bring that up about, when we were talking about, like, these video games and war games and all that, I really don't know anything about them. I don't play them, even though I do know people in the casino business who are in their 30s and even 40s who play these games all the time. But what you got me thinking about just then was, what I learned, and I was, you know, I stood before the draft and for Vietnam, and they took only up to, it was the lottery, they took the first 50 birthdays, and mine was 146, so I didn't have to go. But, you know, when I learned about war, really, I learned about talking to my friend's older brothers who actually came back from over there and what they had to say about it. And it had a big impact on me because I was hearing the truth of what they went through, and it seemed pretty damn horrible. You know, it wasn't, you know, Fox News telling me that war is good and all that. I heard it from the source. And I don't think the young people are hearing that today. They're hearing all these fantasies about what's going on over in Iraq and Afghanistan and all of that. And I think that makes a difference.
And also, Carol, within that framework, look at the transformation that took place from a conscript army to a so-called all-volunteer professional military.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that when we went to an all-volunteer military is the same time at which, and of course it was ramped up in later years, especially during the George W. Bush years, but it's also when we begin to see the rise of the cult. And I don't use it in any negative terms. I use it in its anthropological sense, the cult of the warrior.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get that, then you don't get people coming back talking honestly as much as you did, say, in the Vietnam era, because the Vietnam era was fought by young men, largely, who didn't necessarily want to be there, but had to go because their daddy couldn't get them in the Texas Air National Guard Champaign unit. So there's no getting around the fact that there is a Gordian knot of problems here. But the problem, the myth of the Gordian knot is this humongous knot that no one had been able to take apart. And taking apart the Gordian knot in the age of Alexander the Great was one of those harbingers of the chosen one, if you will. And Alexander had to take it apart. So what he did, though, being the barbarian that he was, instead of sitting there and staring at it and trying to find where the end was and get it loose, he came up, drew his sword, and hacked it to pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And to a certain extent, I think we have to find somewhere to start in this larger cultural process. After which we can start, we can go to work on other things. And so I merely suggest getting these militarized weapons off the streets and out of people's hands as a starting place. And that's not to say anybody's coming for anybody's double-barreled shotgun or the squirrel rifle that's come down through 19 generations or hell, even handguns.
Well, I hope that and we've talked about it before, it's difficult to see major changes coming, but hopefully maybe this will start something. Maybe when they get together and they start agreeing on things like assault weapons and clips and gun shows, maybe they'll say, well, why stop here? Maybe it will start something, and I certainly hope it does. I really do.
I do too, but I'll be quite candid, I don't expect it to. You mentioned a few minutes ago that maybe they'll come together and do something. No, I don't see it happening. I see it being much more a matter of the usual people who support sanity with regard to these issues talking their sanity. And I mean, let's assume for a minute that the Senate can get it done, and that's not a surefire thing. The question then becomes, what will get done? In other words, how will the legislation be drafted? Will they learn from the mistakes of the previous assault weapons ban? And if they do get it done, then the problem becomes, it has to go to the House of Representatives. And at this point in time, anything that has to go through the House of Representatives, Carol, is going through bedlam.
Oh, exactly. But there is a lot of pressure right now. You're seeing even some people on the right, we're saying, something has to be done now. So, I trust me, I am probably the least best candidate for, being optimistic, but maybe something will change this time. Look, you had the Connecticut shooting, and then you had this nutcase right on the heels of it with the same rifle start shooting firemen. So I think it's caused some problems for some of the people that normally would put up roadblocks. Don't you think it, can't you see a little difference this time? Because I do, and I'm not predicting that it'll work, but I do see a little difference.
It feels different. I think it's going, I think whether there is any tangible or palpable difference, Carol, has to do with whether or not people keep up pressure on the NRA. Every time they trot out Wayne LaPierre hallucinating his brains out, as he apparently does every waking minute of the day, if there are 500 people outside the venue saying, shut the hell up, Wayne, good. Sunday, it seemed apparent that they're going to stick to their hard line. And they think they've got the political clout to make it stick. In other words, they think that their bought lawmakers are going to stay bought. And the only way that doesn't happen is if there is tremendous pressure brought to bear both on the NRA and its political enablers in Congress.
Well, you know, I'm going to have to get going. I got to get ready for work, but I'm going to make a little prediction here. I'm going to predict that within the next 6 months, I think they are going to renew the assault weapons ban. I really do. I think when the new Congress comes in, I think when some of these families of the people in Connecticut have a little bit of time, I think some of them might get a little more vocal. And I'm going to predict that something's going to change on this. Now, whether it be as big a change as we need, I don't know. But I think the NRA is going to lose on this one. I really do.
I hope you're right. I would be thrilled if the NRA could absolutely be disassembled. And then if we need a National Rifle Association, that it be something dedicated to the hunters and the you know, those law abiding gun owners that we're told whose feelings must be forever guarded. Yeah, but right now it is merely a lobby for gun manufacturers. The most hopeful thing I saw out of any of it, I do know you've got to go to work, the most hopeful thing I saw out of any of it was the financial pressures being brought to bear. And as we find out in this culture whose God is Mammon and not Jesus Christ, and let's not fool ourselves, the real change happens when the money people figure out it's not good for the money. And it seemed, at least in the last 2 weeks, it looks like the hedge fund people who own all the gun manufacturers, well, maybe we don't. And that pressure was brought to bear by people like the California pension and retirement system, the New York system, you know, when they just called whoever manages the funds and said, dump 1 million shares of Sturm Ruger or what have you.
Really?
Yeah.
Didn't know that.
Because that drives share prices way the hell down.
Well, and just think, I mean, if they could, and again, I'm going to stand by my prediction. I might be wrong. I hope I'm not. But if they were to put a voluntary buyback out there of some kind, and there is a lot of pressure for that right now, there are a lot of people that need money. I think that it would be very difficult to get a mandatory buyback at this point, but I would think you'd be really surprised at how many people would be turning all kind of weapons in on a buyback because they're just strapped for cash.
And that's one of the reasons that the people who hoard guns have hoarded them for so long. They are incredibly liquid assets.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody's always out there who wants to buy your gun.
That's true, but when the economy's so bad and there's people that don't have any disposable income, whether it's guns or anything else, it's going to be hard to move it, you know. But anyway, like I said, you know, I'll put that prediction out there, and we'll see in the next several months.
I hope you're right. I want to be wrong on this so badly, I can't express it.
Well, in the next several days, you know, as I listen to your show, I'll be interested if the people who are listening to this, if they have any comment on this, and see what they think, too.
Well, and we've already got some comments in the queue, so I'll share those as soon as we wrap up.
Okay, well, you know, go ahead and move on to the other people and, you know, have a happy new year and all that. I'll be working, of course, and I'll talk to you down the line.
All right, take care, Carol. It's awful good to hear from you. Happy new year to you.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye. From Las Vegas, that's our buddy Carol. I do have some comments. Randy in Pennsylvania noting that a partial cause of the media's failure is the U.S. State of Emergency Declaration, which gets renewed about every 6 months. Randy notes that it used to be listed under State of Emergency on Wikipedia. He says that declaration seems to have cowed the U.S. media from actually doing what it's supposed to do. Jack in Shreveport says, we can follow the insanity of how Fox, for example, is allowed to spew lies 24/7 to how our government has allowed the media to consolidate and to become totally unregulated. From there, as we all know, the rule of our representatives by money is the number one corrupting factor. But the money comes from those who have accumulated vast wealth and yet still will do basically anything to accumulate yet more. That is what is truly insane, and it is an issue that we have not even questioned or explored. Not only do we need to ask why a person would want that much, but we should ask why we, as a society, should even allow it. Jack also points out, if there's something that can be classified as to having committed a long train of abuses, it's got to be Fox News. This crap is not free speech. We've got to figure out a way to delineate the difference. And that's a hard question within the First Amendment. Ray says, the thing is, Bob, if we take a good hard look at the Becks of the world, well, they're coming for you next. And, you know, anybody with the filing fee and a typewriter can file a lawsuit. But by the same token, I don't think we're preying on the minds of anybody here, like any given day of, you know, Beck. We do try to be factual. David in South Carolina, under the subject line paranoid, says, if these folks would look at U.S. history, it is white men they should be terrified of, since white men have led the USA into every war, depression, recession, and man-made disaster the USA has ever been involved in. And that's true, too. And then this from Kate on the Front Range in what she describes as sub-zero temps. Ew. She says, Bob Alexander was right on. The only way to solve the Gordian knot is to whack at it with Occam's razor, keeping it simple. Just saying. Kate says, I love to hear Carol call in. I agree that those years ago were different. Hey, Kate says, I'm here in Montana. Ain't nothing gonna change. Just saying. And let's keep it rolling. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening. How you doing, sir?
Hey, Jim. Hope you had a good Christmas.
Oh, pretty good. Pretty good. Yourself?
Oh, very good, I thought.
I'm glad. Pursuant to your last caller, I agree with him about the deleterious influence of Fox News. And it's nothing but a propaganda machine. And they put out so many lies and so many prevarications, and what's worse, they will mix truths with half-truths, and for me, half-truths are worse than lies, and that's exactly one of the reasons that I think we're having a lot of problems in this country and so much disagreement among people, and people...
Manufactured disagreement.
Manufactured disagreements, and people being unable to coalesce. And as far as the gun companies and the NRA are concerned, I don't think you're going to see any change in these people. They're going to hold on like Charlton Heston until it's taken from their dead, ugly hand. And they're just going to wait these series of shootings out until people don't think about them anymore, because they're so worried about, number one, losing their unemployment benefits, and the other things that are happening that are going to occur if Congress doesn't get together and do its job. And as far as hope in the Senate is concerned, in order for them to do anything, they got to have a 60% majority.
Yep.
That ain't going to happen. I mean, these people are just going to wait until things slide right over whatever they have to wait to see it slide over. It's not going to take any money out of their pockets. It's not going to hurt them in the slightest. Nor will it hurt the 1%.
Although I did find it interesting, our buddy Dennis down in Kentucky, Jim, sent along an editorial cartoon. And it was from a Kentucky newspaper. It was from the Lexington Herald, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows, Mitch, the top panel is a series of squares showing caricatures of political elected representatives in Kentucky. And it said NRA scorecard. and it said McConnell A, Rand Paul A, Hal Rogers A, Ben Chandler A. But underneath it was a panel the width of all of those little squares that just showed a silhouette of a graveyard and a tombstone with a teddy bear on it, and it merely said, incomplete. That's a Kentucky newspaper.
Well, that's an exception, not the rule in Kentucky, I can tell you that right now.
And Mitch McConnell is beginning to worry a right smart little bit. Because there's more and more talk that he may be opposed in his next reelection run, which is 2014, by his worst nightmare, a smart woman.
Well,
in the form of Ashley Judd.
Well, that's fine, but Mitch McConnell's not worried. He's not going to be hurt by any of this. He's set. So why should he put himself out to do anything extraordinary?
I don't think it's that he's going to do anything extraordinary. It may be that his power to do anything extraordinary becomes somewhat limited.
Or to use his power, or whatever power he has. I think his power is almost virtually without power.
When we talk about the Senate, Jim, we have to talk about the degree to which power is accorded him. A lot of the Senate's obstructionism could have been taken care of with fairly simple fixes to the filibuster rule that Harry Reid was not willing to do because Harry Reid is not a man of great conviction or courage.
Well, past being prologue, I predict the future for Harry Reid. He'll just leave with a wonderful retirement, and he'll just sit back on his laurels and enjoy the rest of his days and let the rest take care of itself. While the rest of the country goes to hell. I think that's the attitude this guy's taking, basically. It's just one of total and complete resignation.
Where we're just going to be enveloped by our ennui?
Yeah, exactly. Our old ennui. I love that word. First time I heard it used was in a lyric by Brian Ferry. This was, of course, after 4 years of French, but nonetheless, it brought it to mind. But that's exactly right, ennui. And, you know, I've got mine. Bye. See you later. I tried, or I did this. And, you know, you see these people in the Senate and the House of Representatives. And here again, Washington has become so insulated and so inured to the needs of the country that they are taking care of themselves first. Because, in my opinion, most of them are the best that money can buy. Wall Street, K Street. And they're not paying attention to their constituents. Because in many cases, with many of them, except some of the rising Republicans or something like that, a lot of these guys are just ready to get out of the business and go into some other type of think tank or whatever they're offered. You know, kind of like DeMint did. I mean, you know, DeMint was so controversial, and now he's going to go and head the Heritage Foundation. Is that it?
Yes.
Boy, that's a character, isn't he?
The Heritage Foundation. I don't know what. I mean, I would expect
Cato Institute.
But with Jim DeMint in charge of the Heritage Foundation, I'd just expect the streets to be running with moonshine.
Well.
They're crazy drunk mean, I guess is what I'm going
for. Well, maybe that's the reason that the Discovery Channel has been doing all these specials on the moonshiners. Have you seen that?
Yeah. I think that's another case of us amusing ourselves to death, isn't it?
No, it's not. I mean, they're making a hero out of people like Popcorn Sutton and these guys who were running distilled liquor and stuff like that, the moonshiners, and they're making...
Rugged individualists, Jim.
Now they're making them into, like, heroes.
Yeah.
Who can, you know, avoid the ABC, and they're portraying them as rugged individuals who Well, I do the best I can to feed my family, so if I got to shine, I got to do moonshine and stuff like that. That's what's going on over the Discovery Channel. It's a whole series. Have you not seen it?
Yes, I have. I haven't seen, you know, a number of episodes, but
I... Oh, you ought to watch it. I mean, you need to see it.
Do we really need me to scream that much more in my life, Jim?
No, you don't have to scream. I mean, you just need to sit back and watch what... You know, with the medium being the message. And I'm sure that particular documentary, and I've watched each and every one just to see exactly what they're going to say and how they're going to justify these guys and what they do. And they're going to take it all the way down to Junior Johnson, the hero of NASCAR and stuff like that. And that's how Junior, back in Wilkes County, North Carolina, got his start, was running Shine. These are like the Robin Hoods. That type thing. That's they're for like anti-heroes or
heroes. Folk heroes, yeah.
Yeah, they are, and they're, you know, literally legendizing and idolizing these people. So it's just the whole thing are turned upside down. I mean, I've enjoyed watching some of the stuff about moonshine and hearing some of the stories and stuff like that, but and then I think about, well, what does this stuff do to people? I mean, you know, cutting it with Clorox, stuff like that, you know.
Oh, there's plenty of bad shine stories out there.
Absolutely. People losing their sight, their lives. And
stomachs.
And, yeah, exactly. But the thing about it is, it's just like the whole media is just focused on a lot of things that give people a lot of bad ideas. And I dare say... that Fox News has contributed to 50% of our problems in this country, of our unable to being to resolve any kind of problem. And number two, these anti-hero type things, like this thing on moonshine and stuff like that, and we go avoid the government, and we've got our weapons to defend ourselves. And all these guys on this thing on moonshine, they're all armed with automatic assault weapons.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, you know, and, you know, it's a way of encouraging people who need money to go out and generate some income by putting together an illegal distillery. I mean, if that, the impact is that great, it's on the Discovery Channel, it's been repeated. They've got a new session coming up on the first of the year, and there it is, and there you have it. But like I said, or tried to say earlier, I don't see much of a change in the position and stance of the NRA because they're going to hold on because they've got too firm a hold. And as far as a buyback program is concerned, that's only going to work if the firearm was purchased legally. You're not going to get a buyback on an illegally purchased firearm.
Why couldn't you? Why couldn't it be no questions asked?
Because that's not the way the law usually works, Bob. That's something they'll insert into it, saying the firearm must be legally purchased, and you've got to have a bill of sale, serial numbers, and all the stuff on weapons. Mark my words, that will come into any type of buyback program in which they have any input, which will in turn discourage people to keep these weapons in their possessions and hidden because they don't want to go to jail. Because, I mean, when you turn in a weapon like that, the police are going to, the first thing they're going to do, they're going to ask you, where did you get it? From whom was it purchased? And how much did it cost you? And why do you have it?
But there have been other gun buybacks that have not been that way, Jim.
I don't think this one will be like that. Now, maybe.
Well, that's my fear, and that's what I tried to enunciate in talking with Carol, is that my fear is that this will be subjected to that Bismarckian "you don't want to see laws or sausage being made" process until it winds up being. You know, I'm not going to sit here and say that the last assault weapons ban was a complete failure, but it was not. Neither was it a resounding success.
No, it wasn't.
And it needs to be done in very simple fashion, without these confounded loopholes that say that talk about the minutia of the firearm in such a way as to get the firearm out of the categorization. You know, I find it interesting that the NRA complains about that in the last assault weapons ban, but consider that those things were in the last assault weapons ban by virtue of the lobbying of the NRA.
Well, Bob, laws are laws, and laws are written, and laws are written with loopholes and all types of ways in which the very nature and purpose and spirit of the law is, in fact, defeated by the way in which it is to be enforced. And that goes throughout the history of...
Well, that's not firearms. That's legislative process.
Well, whatever. The effect is the same. The legislative process controls the distribution, acquisition, and maintenance of weapons. I think they'll find some way to get around that. I really do. I mean, you may as well be prepared for it.
Well, that's why I am being as cynical as I am. Again, the way I phrased it, if you get it through the Senate, then it has to go over to the political equivalent of Toontown, where there are, you know, anvils falling out of the sky and people singing arias to pink elephants.
Right. And no fact begins with if, does it?
Right.
You're talking in the subjunctive mood, and it's not the indicative. Well, that's all I had to say, buddy. I wish you well. You have a good evening.
Well, I'm sure going to try, and we'll just keep at it, and I look forward to hearing from you again, Jim.
All right, you take care. All my best to you and your family.
Thanks. Bye now. Our good buddy, Jim. Let's go over to Skype. Will is with us. Are you there, Will?
Yes, I am, Bob. Good to hear from you. Hope that everyone here is having a happy holiday season. And like many of you, I'll be glad to say farewell to 2012 and hello to 2013. I will say that Wayne LaPierre has done something remarkable. He has finally exposed his true face to the public, and it's probably something that if his face actually resembled his positions, it would probably be the top horror movie star of our time. He had no argument whatsoever that made any sense, and he seemed to completely ignore the fact that Columbine, there was a security guard, and that Fort Hood, there were lots of people with firearms in an incident that where many were killed and wounded. Just that I think we are beginning to see a sea change because people have had enough. When it was just a matter of kids in the inner city being shot, people could dismiss it as something that happens in crime-ridden neighborhoods with gun problems. But now you can go anywhere in the country, and in theory you can be a victim of a shooting with a weapon that has more firepower than my grandfather used during World War One. So I think we are going to see a few changes, but it's going to be uphill because...
And I guess the question Jim is asking, Will, and Jim and Carol are on opposite sides of the spectrum here, not in terms of ideology, but in terms of... in terms of how they view the process, or perhaps optimism is the simplest form. Will the changes be cosmetic or substantive?
That reminds me of the old story about a boy who went to a teacher with a bird in his hand and asked his teacher, well, tell me if the bird is dead or alive, and the teacher said, it depends on you. And it is going to depend on us. We should be out there bugging our members of Congress and members of the Senate, even if we don't have much faith in them, so that at least our voices are registered. Any social change in this country comes through hard work and organizing, and it's very seldom immediate. Is it worthwhile? Yes. Why? Because I know people who are in their 90s who have seen things that in their youth they thought would never happen. the Civil Rights Act, people gaining more marriage equality, people having more and more access to rights and technology that's beyond the imagination of some of our best minds 50 years ago. So I think we can get there. The question is, will we have the courage and determination? Because Wayne LaPierre may be one man, but his backers in the ammo and gun industry have millions, if not billions, to spend on campaigns. And unlike the Horn, which is entirely listener-supported, they have pundits who are being paid to go ahead and tell the NRA version of the story. And while I'm at it, I should emphasize, if anyone in the sound of my voice is so moved, feel free to help out with the Horn, because we need more outlets like this where you can get your opinion across and where the person who is speaking into the radio microphone as a host is not thinking, what do my financial backers have to say? So it's going to be a hard fight, but I think we can get there. The key thing is to tell ourselves we're not going to quit, because we are sick of it. We're sick of the dead kids on the streets of Chicago. We're sick of the dead kids in Newton, Connecticut. And we're sick of people acting as if there's nothing that can be done, that only a perfect solution will work. Well, guess what? Anti-drunk driving laws and anti-drunk driving campaigns are not perfect and do not prevent any injury or death, but they have had an impact. If you seek perfection, you will not achieve any good in this world. So let's try to do what is good, what's right, and move forward, and have hope in our hearts and determination in our steps. Because the people who are willing to let the status quo exist are just as determined. We have to be more so.
I think there's a lot of truth in what you say, Will. And thank you for the kind words about the Horn. All the help we can get is about, well, it's all the help we can get. There's a lot of, I perceive a lot of cynicism. I'm seeing it in the chat room just now.
It's understandable why we are, because we have done nothing again and again. There's the phrase that Winston Churchill used about America entering World War II, or even providing assistance to the Allies before then. America will always do the right thing after having exhausted all other possibilities. And I think there is some truth in this, perhaps not just for America, but for humanity as a whole. Sometimes we have to be kicked and prodded and led into going forward to a better path. But
well, you open the door to a larger philosophical discussion, insofar as how can every success that has ever come along, from the first wheel to the first good arrow point, has been deemed a success because the things that came before it were failures or were insufficient in some wise. So
exactly. Consider this. For every success that we read about, there's a lot of failures. Not even Michael Jordan made every shot. Babe Ruth did not hit every ball. But the key thing is, they kept on trying. And that's what we have to do, even if we are weary and our hearts are breaking. Because who else are we going to depend on? I don't believe in political messiahs. It's up to us to do it. Then perhaps along the way we'll have a few people in Congress and elsewhere say, look, the public's demanding this. I personally agree, and I can convince my stubborn colleague in the next district over to go along with the public for no other reason save the fact that he wants to get his pension. So we have to realize we have power, and I think that one of the big points of the lobbying industry, the Koch brothers, and the like, is to convince us we have no power. We should just sit back, consume goods, watch very poor television, and let them rule the world. Guess what? We tried it that way for a few centuries, a few thousands of years. Hasn't worked out too well, has it?
No, and that's in line with what David from South Carolina said a few minutes ago. The folks who say they've got the solutions are generally the folks who, for the last few millennia, have been making all the mistakes.
Yes. So, I mean, if we, the people, decide to act and organize, if someone comes up with a solution, great. If they are an elite and they're kind of like FDR on the right side of things and willing to say, yes, there's a problem, here's how to fix it, I'm willing to listen. But too often we have people like the Koch brothers whose solutions seem inevitably to always favor their bank accounts. It's incredibly amazing how consistent that happens.
And that's because they are absolutely conversant, Will, with the idea of self-interest.
Exactly.
And I think our side is not so much.
We have a strong altruistic streak,
and that's a good thing. But we need to understand that, you know, if we march, for instance, if we march on the NRA, we march on the NRA not just because we don't want another Newtown. We march on the NRA because we don't want it to happen to our families. Not that we'd be okay if it happens to somebody else's, but it has to become visceral like that. Does that make sense?
Yes. Actually, there's a very old saying that comes to mind that summarizes the need for balance and the need for action. It's from Hillel the Sage, who lived about 2,000 years ago and was
60 BC to 20 AD, last I checked.
Exactly.
Sorry, I'm a Hillel fan.
Yes, and this saying is, if I am not for myself, who will be? If I am only for myself, what am I? If not now, when? To put in more today's turn, look out for yourself. Be enough of a person to look out for everything else and take action now, because that's all we're guaranteed to have. If we do so, we can do incredible things. I mean, consider. Now we have people of many different races and genders in the Congress. In a nearby neighboring state, we have the first openly gay senator, Tammy Baldwin, who will soon be sworn in. We have seen a ton of progress. Yes, we have seen a ton of pain, and there's glaring economic inequality. But whatever progress that has been made in this country and this world has been because people have been determined to do so in mass. I mean, sure, occasionally you'll get a benevolent dictator type. The last one I can think about was Cory Aquino in the Philippines, who succeeded her husband and then presided over a constitutional process that led to more democracy. But in the end, it's the people in mass who matter. As eloquent a man as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. would be the first to admit that without the mass movement, the civil rights movement would have failed. We have to, on the left, start realizing it's in our own interest to fight for our own rights and the rights of everyone else. We must love our neighbor, but we must love ourselves. For a friend who's faced a few problems, I've helped to focus on them by saying, okay, imagine someone you know or work with, imagine that person having the same problem. What would you say? Sometimes we have to personalize it and internalize it. Sometimes we have to take a look at what's closest to us and at a little bit of distance. But if we don't act, we play into the hands of those who think we are nothing but cogs in their machinery. My advice is, let us frustrate their efforts and believe in our own power. And there's lots of outlets for doing it. Activism online, precinct committeemen, supporting good progressive organizations like the
Will, and I think this is important, being willing to look outside our own particular issues.
Exactly.
The right wing is very good at this. The Save the Little Fetuses crowd will happily march in support of an end to the death tax. Right? Our side tends, or at least the way I've experienced it, we tend to think in terms of our own issue. And we need people who are environmentalists to march in support of mothers who want to stop burying their children. We need organized labor to step up on this. Everything that considers itself to be progressivism needs to understand that there is only one progressivism, and it is human rights.
Exactly. The only way I can be secure in my rights as a human being is if others are secure as well. My naked, narrow self-interest in looking after your rights is the assumption that you may well be altruistic to look after my own. Because if I have your back, chances are 90% of the people around me will want to have mine. And this is what any tyrant fears. People waking up and finding their own strength and realize that the person they might not have thought of as an ally is. And that is what I think will ultimately save us. Seeing that we are not alone, that we have allies in common cause, and rather than calling ourselves an environmentalist and LGBT supporter, spokesperson for this or that issue, we can say, I'm a progressive and I support rights for all people, because in the end, that's what matters. My rights are only safe when yours are too. And if we realize it, I don't think there's anything that can stop us.
Well, I think there's a lot of truth in what you say, Will. And again, you know, some cynicism. Benedict is in the chat room, and he says, a gay senator does not affect the bank account of the Koch brothers. We will be given our quote-unquote victories from time to time, but they will be tokens and will not be victories that change the balance.
Well, then we're going to have to kick and fight every step of the way, simply because if we don't, we already make the Koch brothers happy, and even if we lose along the way, if we can keep them up late at night sweating, consider it something that is in our narrow self-interest. We may not have all the victories that we want, and they're probably going to be hard won. But if we're not in the arena fighting every step of the way for our rights and the rights of others, we've already given the would-be emperors their victories.
And I think we have to take reality into account. That may sound like an overly simple statement. I don't mean it to sound that way. But we do have to take reality into account, and I think we take it into account with a view of history at hand. You know, there has been another time in this country where a group of reactionary members of the Congress have been able to stall anything good from happening. And we saw where that ultimately wound up. And frankly, all the secession talk immediately in the aftermath of the election was frightening, because it means that, well, and the people who were talking it were idiots, of course, but they are idiots who would gladly run to the ramparts if told to do so by the right people.
Exactly. There's always people like that. And I mean, we have to realize that the Koch brothers and those like them who are funding Limbaugh et al. Are playing for keeps. We have to play for keeps as well.
Indeed. Indeed. And remember, that has to do with how Congresses are made, because, you know, it's not just the Civil War based legislation that wound up making a profound difference in what this country became, but rather it's also the legislation that was passed simply because it could be passed without the obstructionism of the southern states in the Congress. Look, the law that created state colleges and universities was passed in 1862 and signed by President Lincoln. It could never have passed with Alabamistan and Mississippistan and Tennessee and Arkansas in the Union, in the Congress. So one wonders ultimately what the answer to that question is. And I frankly don't know it.
Well, I'm hoping that from what I'm seeing of the changing demographics in different parts of this country, that we will see Lindsey Graham's fears. There are not enough old, angry white men to keep the Republican Party going, will eventually be proven true. I mean, good heavens, the thought that within a decade or so, Texas may be a swing state should be considered amazing. But I think too often, in the short run, we tend to despair, and it's understandable that we do, because let's face it, things are not where they should be. But if we have hope for the long run, even if all we do is just get things started and perhaps hand the torch to others, we've at least done our part. The work is hard and the labor is long, but all of us are called to do what we can do. Because if not us, who will it be?
And there has to be, we can't just think in terms, Will, of the other side that has to be gotten around. We've got plenty of work to do on our own. I think back in particular to the early days of this first term of Barack Obama, when Eric Holder wanted to have a discussion about semi-automatic military style firearms. Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel looked at the Attorney General of the United States and told him to shut the fuck up about guns.
Yes, and here is the
and yet there's nobody out there. You know, he's the mayor of Chicago, and Chicago is an abattoir of gun violence.
Exactly. There are neighbors.
Is there anybody picketing the mayor's mansion and reminding Rahm Emanuel that there's a darn good reason to not shut the F up about guns?
I know there was a protest about schools recently at his house, but I mean, too often I think we're afraid to take action, and I think if we have allies and we disagree with them, we have to disagree openly, and I think that we have to be wary of having too much unity for the sake of unity. I mean, good heavens, if Eric Holder had decided to argue that point and saying, well, look, would you want the next Columbine to happen in your hometown? Well, I think maybe he could have gotten through, but I mean, part of the problem with the Democratic Party is that in most other countries it would be a few different parties, but it's generally what we have to work with on the national level.
True, but I think I'm trying to raise a little bit of a larger question, and that is to say that at the time that statement was made to Eric Holder, because the only job first-term president has in the United States is to become a second-term president, at which point he becomes, he starts quacking the day after his second inauguration, because he's a lame duck. On the other hand, and this is why I have asked, whether we've got the good sense of the Australians, and it may not be a question of good sense as much as it is a question of the structure of the system. Now, John Fox just reminded me a few minutes ago that the NRA lobbied hard to try to stop, the NRA from the U.S. lobbied hard to try to stop the assault weapons ban in Australia. But for the most part, the people weren't having it, and they didn't have the entrenched power that they have here. But there's also a governmental structure that isn't winner-take-all. And so I think there are multiple symptoms to our sickness, Will.
Yep.
That make our cure more difficult than the cure for just about any other so-called first world nation on the planet.
Well, in part because everyone else was able to learn from our examples and mistakes. It might be harder, but if we don't do it, we're the only ones who are going to suffer. I hate to say we are going to be in for a hard fight on many issues, but that is unfortunately the nature of the system. Nothing good ever seems to come easily here.
And again, I come back to the fact that there are 2 million people who are going to lose their unemployment benefits and have absolutely nothing. And yet I'm part of the problem here because I've spent a hell of a lot more time talking about firearms than I have about food. You know, there is a difference between guns and butter.
Yes.
And the problem there is not going to be Democrats who want to give away too much, but rather the problem will be the Republicans in the House who are supported by the same people who cheered in that debate pageant during the Republican nomination process, who cheered when Ron Paul suggested someone just be left to die in the hallway of the hospital.
Yes, and these are the same people who claim to be followers of one Jesus of Nazareth, for the most part, who would not ignore beggars or lepers, with lepers being the most unwelcome people of their society. We have to really focus on a bunch of issues, and it's going to be hard. I think we have enough obstructionism to build stone walls as big as the Great Wall of China, but it's going to have to depend on us because...
Well, and precisely, precisely nothing will happen if we do not try.
Exactly. If we don't try, if we don't make an effort, we've already signed them a win. If we do try, we have a chance. It might be a fighting chance, but at least it's something. At least we will have registered our voices, and there might be some who take pause. And if it doesn't work now, it doesn't mean it doesn't work down the road. Consider this. The civil rights movement was not just a matter of actions in the 60s, but prior actions that had gone decades and decades back. The thing is, you can never tell where you are in the process, where you have that moment that causes everything to change. Possibly we are there for some issues, but not others. But if we don't do the work, we don't know.
If we don't do the work, we're nowhere. Absolutely.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Will, thank you very much for some very, very considered thoughts. I do appreciate it, and I hope we will talk soon.
Talk to you soon. Be well. And by the way, folks, still time to donate to the Horn.
Thanks, Will. Thanks a lot. And he is, of course, correct. We are $10 away from meeting Sparky's Horn Malloy Skype chat challenge. And it would be nice to make that up and maybe make a little bit of distance toward the rest of the evening's $150 fundraising goal. Through a very kind contribution, a couple of contributions over the weekend, yesterday, even though there was no show, got taken care of. So that's inspiring. So there's $10 to go on Sparky's challenge, and after that, $50 to go just to finish the night. Onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
This is Edward in Dallas.
Hey, Edward, how are you?
I'm fine. I just saw some stuff on the news that I thought might be entertaining. There's a Tea Party insurrection.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know they could spell it.
Well, anyway, Dick Armey, his wife, and his aide, wearing a handgun, showed up at the Freedom Works headquarters and ordered everybody out.
Wow, that's That takes some brass.
And according to the news that I watched, they wanted to get rid of Matt Kibbe, who was writing a book or something. And it's just obvious, evidently, that Army wants money. And, of course, he has plenty of money. He lives over here in Irving, Texas. And they paid him like $8 million. He ought to be able to live on that for a while. I think I could do very fine on that.
I don't know. In that crowd, that may only qualify as pin money, Edward.
Well, you're right. You're probably right. Yeah, well, see, he was a professor of economics at North Texas State University.
Lord, don't you feel sorry for anybody who took the class?
Oh, I know. A lady took the class, and she told me, she says, I took economics from him, and that's why I don't know anything about economics.
Wow.
Anyway, I just got this off of the news, so I'm sure it's not all correct or anything, but I thought I'd just let you all know.
Well, I appreciate it, Edward. That's rather interesting. I can't think of a nicer bunch to see fall apart at the seams.
Oh, absolutely. Well, my favorite thing about Dick Armey is I listened to this comedian and a very good interviewer years ago who when Dick Armey first burst on the scene, and he was told about Dick Armey, and I can't tell you who it was, but anyway, he said, Dick Armey, that sounds like the chorus line in a gay nightclub. I love it.
Beautiful. You have a good evening, Edward.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye now. Calling from the Dallas area, that's our good buddy, Edward. Interesting piece of information along these lines coming in from Kevin in Colorado Springs. All I've got here is a headline from, the Denver Post? Yeah. Colorado gun background check system tops out as checks still pour in. Does that mean their system's crashed? Wow. Because people are out there buying guns like, well, crazy? Oh, Lord. I don't like where this is leading. By the way, thanks, Jack, for helping us finish off the Horn Malloy Skype challenge. It is much appreciated. I've got something here from Dr. Bill. And one of the things that we are excited about is in the coming month, weeks really, we're going to be putting together a concerted effort to bring Dr. Bill back to the air. If you have never heard a Prism or seen a Prism chat section, you don't know what you're missing. If you have, then you know what you're looking forward to. Dr. Bill is technically on vacation. However, he can't stop thinking. The snow is falling up in Connecticut where he is. I hear it may get deep in Massachusetts tonight. We haven't seen much in the way of snow here. Just rain and a lot of high winds and that sort of thing. But Dr. Bill cannot resist thinking and writing, and when the moment is on him, it always works out well. He just sent me a piece a few minutes ago. Whether it's guns, deranged psychotics, or violent video games, there is an answer. I was reminded of what Dr. Bill had written in talking with Will. Whether it's guns, deranged psychotics, or violent video games, there is an answer. The ironies, Dr. Bill says, are everywhere. Those most wedded to guns most often vote Republican. Those most eager to ban guns don't. Those most certain that our violence problem is one of deranged individuals receiving inadequate diagnosis and treatment or watching too many video games find themselves advocating medical and social services they've always dissed as examples of wasteful spending and liberal coddling. Gun opponents most disturbed by the Second Amendment pretend to endorse it, but only when ammunition clips hold 5 or 10 rather than 100 rounds. And in the strangest example of reverse psychology of all, the NRA promises an end to gun violence by making guns more accessible, not less. Archie Bunker proposed this same NRA solution for plane hijackings in the 1970s. Issue a gun with each boarding pass, he reasoned, and only those bent on suicide would dare try to commandeer a plane when everyone on it is armed. The only real difference between Archie's solution and that proposed by Wayne LaPierre lies in the public's response. In the 1970s, millions laughed as Michael Stivic, son-in-law and foil for Archie's hilarious, rather Machiavellian approach to common sense, tried in vain to reason with a logic devoid of humanity and oblivious to the realities of community responsibility and social conscience. Whereas, in 2012, when the NRA speaks, nobody laughs. Instead, tens of millions ponder on a solution that seems to merit serious consideration, the fall line between advocates and opponents seeming to mirror almost perfectly the dysfunctional divide that stymies today's politics. And in the most ideologically poignant irony of all, those most sensitive to the need for a living constitution avoid even a mention of original intent to limit gun ownership to a citizen's militia obligations, while those most enamored with that same Bork-Scalia criterion to determine constitutionality seemingly employ every contemporary living constitution argument available to them to defend the right to bear arms, except for the one that the founders originally intended. Dr. Bill continues, at the risk of contradicting myself by suggesting that there just might be a solution to the conundrum I have just rendered unsolvable, I respectfully suggest education as a long-term remedy to the scenarios sketched out above. Education, however, that is quite different from that currently being practiced in America's classrooms. And this, of course, goes back to the very heart, I think, of some of what Carol was talking about. The kind of education suggested here is one that truly changes people, that truly makes them more human rather than simply better informed. Suggested more than 50 years ago by philosopher Mortimer Adler, How to Read a Book, in his distinction between reading for information and reading instead for enlightenment and understanding, it involves the kind of knowledge that Plato told us about 2 millennia ago when he charged society's educators, those who had exited the darkness of ignorance and experienced the light of truth, to re-enter the cave and find a way to activate and engage the knowledge that already exists within each of us. This, Plato reminds us, is not new information introduced into the human soul, but that universal knowledge that already exists there. While Plato was sure that only the very few could comprehend and appreciate this kind of education, America's founders committed this republic to providing a real chance for every citizen to experience it. It is important for all of us to realize, especially during this period of reflection and mourning, that a society properly enlightened about and respectful of the good life, about what really constitutes love and true happiness, and about responsibilities that citizens owe to each other and to the common good of all, does not produce citizens who place self-interest or greed above the public interest. Ever. It is this commitment, more than any other, that is the basis for what so many define as American exceptionalism. America's true greatness, we must all appreciate, is not measured by what happens to some of us, but what can happen to all of us. Let's go back and do that again. America's true greatness, we must all appreciate, is not measured by what happens to some of us, but what can happen to all of us. And that, we will surely come to understand, is the product neither of ideology nor economic truism, but rather of the way we respect and treat one another. St. John Chrysostom, as early as the 4th century of the current era, reminded early Christians that, quote, the seeking of the common good was the rule of the most perfect Christianity, its most exact definition, its highest point. Nothing, he wrote, can so make a person an imitator of Christ as caring for neighbors. This is, we must come to understand, a goal to be pursued, not one already achieved and presumed to be under attack. It calls particularly for a kind of education that students, all students, will see as quite relevant. It is neither trivial nor boring. It calls forth skills and sensibilities that comprise the essence of what employers seek most in employee recruitment. It must begin to infiltrate teacher preparation programs. Therein lies its potential for success. Therein lie also its most challenging obstacles. Wow. You know, it's interesting that Dr. Bill brings in the analogy of the cave from Plato's Republic. I saw a movie trailer earlier today for an animated full feature-length piece about some, of course, comically drawn cavemen. When I saw it, the first thing that popped into my mind, just because I'm funny this way, is how is it the cavemen are always white? You ever notice that? More or less Caucasian, sort of proto-Caucasians. And it was the case here, too, because the young heroine of the film was a green-eyed redhead. She was slightly reminiscent of Fiona from Shrek, absent the green skin. But lo and behold, my pink little ears perked up when she said, "My daddy has one rule, never leave the cave." And I thought, well, bust my buttons, isn't that sly? The boys over at DreamWorks are going to introduce moviegoers to a little bit of Plato without them even knowing it. Of course, the problem with doing something like that is that the people doing the introduction have to have a functional understanding of what they're introducing. But it really did. I went, what? Curious, indeed. Especially when we talk about, or when Dr. Bill talks about getting people to go back into the cave. And the backside of that is also, what happens when you walk into the cave and say, "I've seen the real world," and most of the people sitting in the cave go, "No, no, no, those shadows on the wall, that's the real world. Remember, we can't move our heads." Right? Worth thinking about by a long shot. Our buddy David in South Carolina, writing in a little bit earlier. "There needs to be a federal effort to confiscate firearms, because if you leave it up to the states, people will just go to some stupid-ass place like South Carolina and stock up on firearms, and it'll take the U.S. military, if necessary, to go in and take the guns if people will not voluntarily surrender them." Sad that this is what it will take. They are not going to voluntarily give up their firearms. The only place I have any difference with that is that if the money is right, they will. David in South Carolina continues, we need a U.S. government pushback against this states' rights BS. States' rights have contributed nothing positive to the USA ever, and it will take the federal government to enforce any gun law changes. They're going to have to push back against the states. In writing that, though, David brought up something that's been on my mind. Precisely about those states' rights. What do we call it when Colorado and Washington enact decriminalization laws for cannabis in the face of federal laws that still say it is a controlled substance? Wasn't that an act of states' rights? Now, granted, neither state declared that the federal law about cannabis was null and void, but isn't this a little bit of backdoor nullification? And please don't send me hate mail telling me that, you know, I don't want people to be able to smoke cannabis in Colorado and Washington. I think people should be able to smoke it all over the place. I think it should be taxed. I think it should be sold in a regulated format, just like liquor used to be, until the free market got hold of that. And you can, well, I remember being a little bit surprised when I first started college out in Missouri to find out that you could buy a bottle of liquor in the gas station. That just struck me as a not good idea. But if we legalize it, then we get to be a little bit more forthright with our kids and talk to them about pot and booze and cigarettes in the same breath, instead of trying to talk to them about pot and cocaine and heroin in the same breath. One is an honest conversation. The other is a giant act of hypocrisy. I heard some hand-wringing person from Washington worrying about, whatever shall we tell the children. My first thought was, you tell the children the same thing you tell them about booze. You're not allowed to buy it till you're 21, and you ought not be doing it now because you have a brain that is still developing and will not be fully formed or properly cooked, as it were. That's probably the wrong term. Until you're about 26. But keep an eye on that issue. I just wanted to throw that out there for consideration, because we don't like it when right-wing state governments, by either plebiscite or legislative action, try to overstep federal legislation, or nullify it for that matter. And yet we find ourselves looking at a situation that we like, generally, the decriminalization of cannabis, and suddenly it's okay. We need to be very, very wary of such conundrum, right? Lottie from the chat room, one of our moderators there, sent along a link saying this was a fantastic idea and should be done in every state, just like sex offenders have to register in the town they live in. The headline says, conservatives furious, local paper prints names, addresses of thousands of gun permit holders. Well, what a surprise. Right-wingers are furious. Aren't they always furious? But conservatives are furious. A local Hudson Valley, New York newspaper has published the names and addresses of thousands of gun permit holders, all pistol permit holders in Westchester and Rockland counties of New York. The Journal News, a subsidiary of Gannett Newspapers, who also publish USA Today, on Sunday published an interactive map, Where Are the Gun Permits in Your Neighborhood? Jim Hoft at the radical right-wing Tea Party blog Gateway Pundit called it outrageous and linked to an embarrassingly unintelligent piece from AMI Global Security, a guns and ammo seller, which calls the publication a massive privacy breach and the latest in a series of over-the-top emotional reactions to the latest shooting tragedy in Sandy Hook, Connecticut, meant to intimidate... Actually, it was in Newtown, Connecticut, Sandy Hook Elementary. Meant to intimidate the lawful and prey on people's fears to exploit the gun-grabbing agenda. Don't they just fulminate so pretty? The News Journal, or the Journal News, I'm sorry, filed a Freedom of Information request with the government. You know, lawfully. Meanwhile, the geniuses over at AMI Global Security, whose only goal in life is to sell more guns, they said, this is an invasion of privacy that does nothing to safeguard law-abiding from the criminal element. One barking dog can herd 1,000 sheep to be sheared. This appears to be an attempt to abrogate the Bill of Rights. If where? Where? Nate, come on, which one? Your right to privacy? You law-abiding gun owners might have wanted to be out there saying a little something when habeas corpus and domestic spying was going down, and some of us liberals was a little upset about it. But nah, you's a sitting at home with your guns, gonna protect American freedom. And the Fourth Amendment went swirly, swirly, swirly down the turlet. But now... it's an attempt to abrogate the Bill of Rights. If Paul Revere had the internet, he would not have needed a horse. Yeah, and, well, okay. And if... I don't know if the if the king of Persia had a few divisions of... a few tank divisions, Thermopylae might not have been such an interesting moment in history either. But what's that got to do with anything?
Please share this with all your fellow Americans who are alarmed by a government encroachment aided and abetted by propagandists masquerading as objective journalists.
And bloggers masquerading as writers in English who don't know that we still put articles in front of nouns. Jesus. So the Second Amendment trumps the First. Now here's the way it shook out from the Journal News. This is what they explained. The database, legally obtained from the county clerk's offices through a Freedom of Information Act request made after the shootings in Newtown, Connecticut, that left 20 children and 8 adults dead, has been called irresponsible, dangerous, and leaning toward intimidation by several online pundits. Social media played a big part in the exponential spread of the story, whose map has been recommended more than 20,000 times. 2 Facebook posts linking to the story on Sunday garnered 346 comments as of this evening. That's in addition to 167 comments posted directly to Facebook.com, LoHUD, since the story published. Numerous additional comments relating to the gun permit map have appeared on posts and other unrelated stories. More than a dozen more people sent private messages via Facebook objecting to the map. The overwhelming majority of comments strongly object to the story. The database was also mentioned in the Drudge Report, Memorandum.com, Breitbart.com, TheGatewayPundit.com, InstaPundit, IOwnTheWorld.com, and Urban Grounds, along with Yahoo, ABC News, and Fox News, among others. More than 500 comments on both sides of the debate accompanied a story on CNN this evening. Hundreds of callers have complained, claiming publication of the database put their safety at risk or violated their privacy. Others claimed publication was illegal. Many of the callers were vitriolic, and some threatened members of the newspaper staff. They'll do that, you right-winger, your gun fiend, your law-abiding gun owner. Well, you're all law-abiding. It's public record. Nobody's saying you're doing anything wrong. But records that are public are accessible to the public, and, well, I mean... I agree with Lottie. These things ought to be of record in every town in America. Because you know what? As a parent, maybe you don't want your child going to a house full of guns. And hence I take you back to the sad story from the beginning of the program, the 12-year-old who shot his 10-year-old brother to death. Maybe you don't want your kid in that environment. How else do you find out? Sir, I'd like to. Do you have a concealed carry permit? You got a house full of guns there? Because I don't want little Timmy kind. Because that's going to make things a little awkward.
Well, I'll show you who's got Second Amendment rights, by God, you lily-livered liberal pinko commie.
Right? Because these folks aren't exactly screwed down real tight. And see, Texas Betsy has actually done that. She says, I asked parents when Lucas was invited to play somewhere when he was little. On the other hand, as noted, at the behest of the NRA, Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, a Democrat, remember? Inserted language into the Affordable Care Act that made it illegal for medical practitioners to ask about firearms in the home. Because, you know, that's some sort of a violation of our Second Amendment rights. Even though the presence of firearms in the home is a known and verifiable predictor of the likelihood of future harm. Wow, huh? Is this the part where we cue up John Mellencamp singing Ain't That America, Home of the Free Baby? Yeah. Because see, when they get agitated, your gun goobers will have a fit over most anything. And the minute your gun goobers start having a fit, the first thing they think about is making sure you know that they're armed and they're willing to do something about the problem that is you. Hence, a New York Times story with which we will close this prayer meeting Wednesday. A New York Times story of Mormon women wanting to live in the 21st century. It was a campaign simply called Wear Pants to Church. It wasn't a campaign called End the Paternalistic Oppression of Our... No. Just Wear Pants to Church. It was aimed toward Mormon women. It has gone global. A number of women actually dared to put on trousers and go to their Mormon church services. The New York Times goes to pains to explain that Mormonism has no official policy against women wearing pants to church, but many women say that they are pressured, peer pressure, one of the strongest forces on the planet, peer pressure, to wear a dress like a proper female. Thousands of Mormon women arrived at church in pants in places like Cambridge, England, Heidelberg, Germany, Austin, Texas, the Marshall Islands, and Kotzebue, Alaska. Then women posted photos of themselves wearing pants to church. As an act of mutual support. Stephanie Lauritsen of Salt Lake City, who started the idea, received death threats for suggesting that women wear pants.
I got my Second Amendment rights and my Second Amendment remedies, and you little women folks with your uteruses and vaginas and breastuses and stuff, you better get a dress on like God wanted you to. You think you're going to be wearing dress? You think you're going to be wearing pants on Kolob?
Ain't prayer meeting fun? However much fun it was, it's time for us to get out of here. Thanks for the considered ideas and dialogue that made the program this evening what it is, and what always makes the program what it is. Thanks for the help in keeping the program on the air. We actually crossed the $150 boundary. Thank you. Thank you, Julie. Thank you, Ed. Thank you, Jack. And thank you, Sparky, for starting the Horn Malloy Skype chat challenge. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this go, all of this happen, this continuing effort. You who contribute your time, your finances, your ideas, your thoughts, your conversation. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie, Sparky, and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thanks to my lovely wife, Agnes, for her help with the show posts. Thanks to John Fox. Thanks to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and AICACT.org. And always, 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 Gina, cutie, it's all for you.
It's Rick Smith time on the Horn.